Shabbos Kestenbaum has been in the news over the last few months, has spent some time, as we know, on the Harvard campus, and is part of a lawsuit against the university because of their response or lack thereof to anti-Semitic activities on campus. And as I say, in addition to speaking at last week's RNC, because of his efforts and other people's efforts, that entire topic of campus anti-Semitism was addressed by the Prime Minister of Israel yesterday in the halls, or I should say in the joint session of Congress. Shabbos Kestenbaum, my pleasure to welcome you to JM in the AM.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And as someone who grew up listening to JM in the AM, I went to Yeshivat Noam for 8 years. And every morning during carpool, my mom would have JM in the AM on. And I remember every Friday she would also put on your interview with Malcolm Hoadline. So wow. To be here.
It's obvious that you have incredible parents who did a remarkable job raising you.
Exactly.
It must have been something for you to hear the Prime Minister, again, maybe not such a big surprise, but it does take some guts to walk into the halls of Congress from 6,000 miles away and from a foreign country and start talking about what's happening on our college campuses here in the United States. What was your reaction to that part of Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech yesterday in Washington?
Well, I thought it was very powerful, and unfortunately it needed to be said. I think calling out Harvard, the Ivy Leagues, and American college campuses more broadly for the moral bankruptcy that they represent is critical. The only way that these universities will change is sustained public pressure. I always say that if the Harvards of the world wanted to combat anti-Semitism, if they wanted to protect Jewish students, they would have done it already. You know, we're now 9, 10 months out from October 7th, and we're still having to fight them tooth and nail. In fact, just yesterday, literally yesterday, Harvard was in court in Boston trying to dismiss our lawsuit with prejudice, saying that we had no standing, saying that our claims were not ripe, and saying that the university is doing a tremendous job at fighting back against anti-Semitism on its campus, which of course isn't true. So it's a damning state of higher education in the United States that in order to receive equity, justice, and fairness, we have to resort to suing them. So I'm deeply appreciative that the Prime Minister called out these universities.
Yeah. Here's the quote. It's not only the campus protesters who get it wrong. And remember, earlier in the speech, he had referred to some of those protesters as Iran's useful idiots. But he says, he continues, it's not only the campus protesters who get it wrong. It's also the people who run those campuses. 80 years after the Holocaust, the presidents of Harvard, Penn, and I'm ashamed to say my alma mater, MIT, couldn't bring themselves to condemn the calls for the genocide of Jews. Remember what they said? They said it depends on the context. Well, let me give these befuddled academics a little context. You know, some of us are somewhat still puzzled by what happened, and you were part of the congressional hearing, and we, you know, the whole country watched the downfall of the majority of those presidents who testified. What was it? I mean, I get the whole context argument, and I understand the silliness behind it. I understand that. But why do you think there was such a hesitancy for them to make definitive statements in front of the entire country regarding the attitude on campus toward Jews?
So I can only speculate, but I would probably say that let's look at the data. So Harvard at its heyday was 25% Jewish. Now it's roughly 4 or 5% Jewish. It's not because Jews got dumber over time. It's because there's been a deliberate effort to get rid of the amount of Jews on campus. In fact, percentage-wise, there are fewer Jews at Harvard today than there were when Harvard had official quotas on how many Jews were allowed on its campus, which really gives you a pretty good picture of the deliberate discrimination. I think Harvard is really scared, not just of its student body, this very angry, vocal, loud minority group of student minority in the sense of numbers. There are not many of them.
Right, right.
They're scared of them, and they're also scared of that same radical, loud group of faculty and professors. They sort of created this environment and this culture for the last number of years where everyone gets to be coddled and have a safe space, where everyone gets to express their views in any way they want, violate all time, place, manner restrictions. They fostered a culture that I'm sure many of your listeners have heard of before, one of DEI, whereby all peoples can be classified in two categories, oppressor and oppressed, and Jews have the misfortune of being mischaracterized as white. So whether it was 40 babies or 40,000 babies beheaded on October 7th, it's sort of irrelevant because, right, as my classmates will tell you, resistance is justified when people are occupied. Right. So I think Harvard is a victim of its own doing. They've created this culture, and they don't want to stand up because it'll just cause a lot of anger and division from their own students and faculty. I think that's probably why you have
so it's a it's a culture war. But the truth is, as you're describing it, it's really more of a numbers game. Harvard and MIT and Penn and the others, I assume it's the same there, or that you have the impression it's the same there. You know, they simply don't, the Jewish community simply doesn't have the numbers or the influence on campus to make the presidents make definitive statements against anti-Semitism. They're much more concerned with either the majority or the significant population on their college campuses that really are either anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, anti-Jew, however you want to put it. And it really comes down to that. So it's a culture issue, and it's really a population or numbers issue as well.
I would say so. And again, the data suggests that across the board, the number of Jews as a percentage-wise has been plummeting basically all of the Ivy Leagues. And I'm happy to be proven wrong, but the numbers don't really lie, and they paint that picture pretty clearly.
You know, obviously, you know the Harvard campus up close and personal. I want to ask you about what's happening now in 2024, practically up there. But before that, the population that does take the point of view that Israel's the oppressor, and you know we're always on the wrong side, depending on what the accusation is. But in this case, you know, as you described, Israel's the oppressor, and the revolution or the reaction is legitimate and all that. Is a significant portion of that population Jewish? In other words, do you come across a lot of Jews on the Harvard campus that are very sympathetic to the quote-unquote cause that wing is espousing?
Yeah. You know, I'll give you an example.
That must be so much more frustrating for you.
Yeah. So after my speech at the Republican National Convention, a former classmate of mine, who I won't say his name, but he wrote a terribly inaccurate op-ed in The Forward. And he said, Shabbos Kesemev doesn't speak for me because I'm a Jew at Harvard Divinity School. And, you know, I've been experiencing very, very different from what Shabbos is experiencing, which is true. What he fails to mention is that he was a student safety marshal in the illegal encampments at Harvard. He took part in rallies that regularly called for the globalization of the Intifada, free Palestine from the river to the sea. Palestine will be Arab. So he sort of failed to mention all of that in his op-ed. So obviously I don't speak for him. So yes, that has been probably the worst part. While it's true that, much like that Charles Dickens line, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, in the sense that Harvard Chabad has record numbers and the amount of people who want to Jewish heritage and are committed to fight for the Jewish people has certainly increased. It is also the case that, yes, especially at Harvard Divinity School, where I'm the only one who wears a kippah, I'm one of like three, I wouldn't even call ourselves Zionists, but three people who believe that Israel has a right to exist and believes in the dignity and sovereignty of the state of Israel. Yeah, it's deeply distressing to know that, again, I'll use Harvard Divinity School as an example, that the majority of the Jewish classmates don't feel that way. And the majority of our Jewish classmates took part in these encampments, and they provided so much legitimacy and validity to all of these anti-Semitic, anti-Zionist protests of, yeah, of course, of course you can call for the globalization of the Intifada, and of course that's not anti-Semitic, because I'm incidentally Jewish, and I don't think it's anti-Semitic. Right. So that part has probably been the most difficult, seeing sort of one of your own who are, maybe they're not anti-Semitic in intent, but they're certainly anti-Semitic in effect, and they are providing so much fodder and red meat to our ideological adversaries. Yes.
You can always depend on our people. Shabbos Kestenbaum is with us. Now, give me the practical aspects of today. Are you going to still be on the campus in August and September of this year? Have you graduated? Will you be there as part of the population? And just practically speaking, you know, when the encampments were, you know, at its height, and by the way, I'd love your opinion about whether you think it's going to again, you know, go in that direction where there'll be encampments on the campus come the new semester. When the encampments were there on the campus, Harvard's a big place, I assume. You know, I went to a really small college where you could see any encampment if there was one from, you know, from every dorm room, every classroom. But I assume it's a big place, Harvard. Do the majority of students not even know that this thing is going on, or it has such an effect that it really affects a large part of the population?
Yeah, everyone knew it was going on. So the layout of the university is such whereby there's the heart and soul of the university is concentrated in Harvard Yard, which is where most of the undergrads live. It's where Widener Library is, Memorial Church. So it's sort of the beating soul of Harvard, and the encampment was smack in the middle of that. So Harvard has a number of different schools. I'm at the Divinity School. There's the Law School, the Medical School, and, of course, the college, which is its largest school. And the encampments took place, as I said, in the center of Harvard Yard. So it became inescapable and unavoidable. So just simply walking to class, you'd be passing it. I myself, when I was walking to class, I would be followed by these self-appointed safety marshals who would monitor my movement, who would record me, follow me in any direction I took. So everyone knew about it. Also, the encampments, in addition to operating on Harvard Yard, also operated right outside of the building where the president of Harvard, who a useless idiot, a feckless leader by the name of Alan Garber, who did nothing for 4 weeks while all of this was happening. So everyone knew about it. And then in terms of the other question you asked as to whether this will happen in the fall, yeah, absolutely. Harvard has given them a green light, not only because they allowed it to happen and continue for 4 weeks, but for your listeners who follow this story, they only provided consequences to 13 students. And then as of 2 days ago, they actually reversed course and they allowed 11 of those 13 students to graduate. They reversed any of the disciplinary actions or consequences they had on those 13. And keep in mind, there were hundreds of students and faculty who took part in the encampments, and only 13 were disciplined. And of the 13, 11 had their disciplinary actions revoked. So I'm working now and over the summer, and really for as long as I can, I'm working with not just the Jewish community at Harvard, but the Jewish community across college campuses and across the country, really to fight back. So today, I was in D.C. yesterday. Today, I'm in Denver, where I'm speaking in front of 1,500 state legislators from across the country, Democrat and Republicans alike, to talk about legislative solutions that they can implement on the state level to combat the world's oldest hatred. I have a relatively robust speaking tour, so if any of your listeners want me to speak, I'm there. But really to educate communities, not just on what's going on, but the best way that we can move forward, fight back, create long-lasting change on a state level, on a federal level, within the universities themselves. So that's what I will be concentrating all of my energies on, so that no student will ever have to go through the experience that I had this last year.
The Union Station protests yesterday got pretty ugly. Do you think there were some Harvard students among them?
It's not that I think. There were. They publicly posted and boasted about it on their social media. The Harvard Palestine Solidarity Group, Harvard Out of Occupied Palestine, Harvard BDS Caucus. I mean, there's like 12 different anti-Israel Harvard groups. And they all posted yesterday that they were proudly in attendance at the Arrest Netanyahu, I wouldn't even call it a rally, it was a riot, where they spray painted Hamas is coming, they vandalized property, they burnt American flags. I mean, it sort of reminds me, when Russia invaded Ukraine, I went to Ukraine and I worked with refugees there, did whatever I could do to help, and I met a volunteer who was volunteering in the Foreign Legion, which is Ukraine's foreign service. And he told me, we're incredibly lucky that the Russians are our enemy. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, they're incredibly stupid. You know, their inability to take Kiev, their disastrous military techniques. And I sort of think of that soldier that I met when I think of the students at Harvard. We, the Jewish people, are incredibly lucky at how morally bankrupt they are, and they're so open and public about it. You know, much like a drug addict, they can't resist. They can't help themselves when they see an American flag to burn it. They can't help themselves.
Your point being better to know your enemy and then be honest in terms of their intentions. I assume that's what you mean.
Exactly. They're unable to help themselves in terms of vandalizing property and calling for ethnic genocide. So we're blessed that our enemies are so open about their intentions, and the greater American society recognizes them for who they are.
Well, this movement, look, we know that, you know, Harvard, Columbia, there are certain campuses that really started the movement last time around during the war. And last time around, meaning during the last time that the student population was on campus. Is it going to happen again across the country? Do you think that this is going to cause a tremendous ripple effect, and really the hundreds of campuses that were affected last year will likely be involved in all these activities in the semester coming up?
Again, I'm happy to be proven wrong, but all indications point to yes.
A national movement, a continued national movement on the college campuses.
Of course, because number one, the universities have not put in place any comprehensive policies that would combat this. That's number one. Number two, none of these universities have resorted to major disciplinary actions, except for the ones in Florida and in Texas, and primarily the ones in the South. But they have given a green light to their students to go ahead and vandalize property, take over university buildings. Look at Harvard University around, I think it was January, you had 9 or 10 students who took over a building for 24 hours, calling for the university to divest from the Zionist entity. And Harvard's reaction was they gave them Twizzlers and burritos in an attempt to coax them out of the building, which of course didn't work. And then they didn't go through with punishing them in any way. So the lesson is, you could take over a university building, we'll give you candy, we'll coddle you, we'll baby you, and hopefully it'll work. And, you know, Dr. Einat Wilf, who's an incredible intellectual and politician, she has this great line where we finally need to treat not just the Palestinian people, but our ideological adversaries on college campuses like the adults they are. We have to take them at their word when they call for the ethnic genocide of Jewish people, when they call for an intifada in our streets in every capital of the world. We have to take them seriously, take them at their word, and these universities don't, because they're so morally bankrupt.
Shabbos Kestenbaum with us. So in answer, just answer my one of the questions I asked in those series of questions. I'm curious about your upcoming semester. Will it find you on the campus or somewhere else?
Well, I just graduated, so I won't be on the campus as much. I will be back and forth in court in Boston, and I will still obviously stay connected with the Harvard Jewish community. So I'll be back there as much as I can, working with students. I'm now a member of the Harvard Jewish Alumni Alliance, which was created shortly after October 7th.
I mean, there have to be high school seniors that are contacting you to ask if it's a good idea to accept their acceptance to Harvard.
Hundreds.
They don't know what to do, right?
I'm on the phone literally every day with prospective.
Do you have any standard students. Advice, or you just basically lay out what the situation is?
I try to just lay out the situation and talk about my experience and sort of allow them to make their own conclusions, because I can't speak on their behalf. I can't tell them what to do or what not to do, because ultimately it's a decision that they have to make. But I always say, look, I had private armed security outside my house for a week. Wow. I lost all of my non-Jewish friends. I was demeaned and bullied in my classroom by students and professors. So if that's the environment that you are potentially okay with encountering, you need to make that decision, but you have to be informed. The main thing is right. being informed and being educated. Look, a lot of students have told me, prospective or admitted students, after having discussions with them for a while, saying, you know, I want to fight back, which, okay, I'm pretty skeptical that is actually something they will do, because there aren't many within the Jewish community today at Harvard who are fighting back. So the fact that we're suddenly going to get hundreds of people fighting back, I'm a little hesitant or reluctant to believe that that's the case. But number two, and this is really for all the Jewish parents who are listening right now, I mean, that's how you want your kid to spend 4 years of their life.
Right.
Just, you know, crying on Fox News that another moron drew a swastika. I mean, that's what I'm doing, and it's not fun. I don't particularly like it, right. but I'm doing it because I'm already there, and I didn't have much of a choice.
Yeah,
but if you're okay with your kids doing that for 4 years, and it's also true that, yes, not every Jewish student encounters that, and many students have been able to avoid this, that's true. I'm not trying to create a broad picture of what's happening. But for many Jewish students, myself included, that has been our experience for not just since October 7th, but for years now.
The lawsuit, I don't know if I described it accurately during the opening to this conversation, but is the lawsuit with other students from other universities? Is it just Harvard? Is it just you? How would you describe what this action is?
Sure. So I'll tell you something interesting, and this is a great Tablet magazine article. There is, for the first time in American Jewish history, a WhatsApp group of roughly 100 Jewish students from across the country, from across all these different college campuses, who are suing their universities. And we are not activists. We are not politicians or professionals. We're young people who've been thrust into a national spotlight, and we don't know what the heck we're doing. So we're in this WhatsApp group. Giving each other advice, networking, telling each other, oh, you should come to this event, you should be with that person. You know, first time in American Jewish history where this is happening, you know, dozens of lawsuits.
There are some prominent lawyers, some in fact on your campus, that are probably sympathetic to your cause that could advise you on this, no?
Yeah. But ultimately, it's the young students who know what we're going through the best.
Right.
So in terms of our lawsuit, it is myself and five other plaintiffs, five other Jewish students at Harvard. They are anonymous, so I can't obviously disclose who they are, nor can I really disclose much about them.
Right.
I'm named. I thought that it was very important to have someone who's public about it, just so people know that there are real people behind this. We are represented by Kasowitz Benson Torres, which is an aggressive litigation firm based in New York. They actually, I think, used to represent Donald Trump, which I always thought was kind of cool. But ever since his legal fate in New York, maybe not so cool. So we filed in January. Kasowitz is also representing students at three other separate lawsuits at NYU, at Columbia, and Penn. And then there are, so these are all separate lawsuits. And then there are dozens of other lawsuits being filed by the Brandeis Center, the Lawfare Project, Stand With Us. And these are basically any college you've heard of, I can pretty much guarantee you they have a lawsuit. So even though our lawsuits are separate and our cases are separate and the judges are separate, at the same time, as I mentioned, you know, with this WhatsApp group, which I think is really funny, we've sort of become friends. And many of us speak at the same conferences together. We help each other out. And yeah, we've become lifelong friends. There's this phenomenon of young Jewish students who were just studying whatever it is they were studying. And then overnight, on October 7th, they just became activists and advocates for their community. And it's incredibly empowering to be part of such a inspiring network of young Jewish students who are sick and tired of being sick and tired and are going to stand up for their civil rights.
Wow. Life is funny. People get tossed into different situations completely unexpectedly. Finally, I think I read this. You'll tell me if I'm right or wrong. You were at one time an Obama supporter. You might still be. I don't know what your politics are. But the reality is you spoke at the RNC, and it sounded like from some of the articles I read that you were hesitant, wondering what type of reception you might get. What was the experience like?
Sure. So certainly many people, at least on Twitter, have made a lot of political assumptions and have said less than kind words to me, which has been pretty difficult. It wasn't really Nick Fuentes and the neo-Nazis sending me death threats that got to me. It was people within the Jewish community who were committing deeply personal attacks against
me. We can be very disappointing, trust me.
Yes. So that's been very, very hard. So I'll tell you something a little behind the scenes, and I'll do some self-promotion. If there's anyone listening who wants me to speak at their shul, I could tell you some more cool stories about this. But right before my speech, so I spoke at the Republican convention, right before the speech, I was hanging out in the speaker's lounge, meeting with all sorts of politicians. You know, J.D. Vance was there, Newt Gingrich, you know, schmoozing the UNC frat boys, who I become friends with, great people. And then right before my speech, they took me from the speaker's lounge backstage. And backstage, there was a smaller room. It was me and it was two individuals, specifically Omer Nitra's parents. Mm. Omer Nitra, of course, the American Jewish hostage in Gaza. Right. And I mean, I'm getting a little emotional again just thinking about it, but I said, you know, there's nothing I could tell you guys, but the strength that they've given me and the strength that they've given, the Jewish community in the United States, yeah, and Jewish students on colleges who are literally putting up posters of their son only to have them ripped down time and time again. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, it's you. It's the students who are giving us strength. So it was very meaningful and it was very moving and very
quite an exchange.
And Omer Nitra's parents were at the Republican convention not to endorse a president, but to endorse policies that would bring home their son. And I was there for basically the same reason. I wasn't there to endorse a president. I was there to endorse policies that would bring the hostages home, right, that would combat anti-Semitism on college campuses, that would reform higher education, that would help and support the state of Israel. And as I've said a million times, the Democratic Convention wants me to speak. If they want any Jewish student to speak, if they want families of the hostages to speak, we would be more than honored. But unfortunately, the party that I registered to vote as the day I turned 18 has become almost unrecognizable. I was actually at the Democratic Convention when I was 17. I was supporting Bernie Sanders, and I had an Israeli flag. And you know, your listeners can Google the story, but I was called a terrorist sympathizer. This is at the age of 17 already. So I've never voted for a Republican in my life. I supported Bernie. I voted for Jamal Bowman in 2020. I volunteered and held fundraisers for his opponent in 2024, George Latimer. So I've done some teshuva. But I'm still a Democrat. There are progressive policies I still believe in. Green New Deal, $15 minimum wage, universal health care. I'm not a Republican. But there needs to be an acknowledgement within my party that we've really lost our way. And I want to help my party. I want to reform it. I like to call myself a Richie Torres progressive. He is my friend and congressman. He's an amazing man and, yep, and obviously champion of the Jewish state. Yep. And he's an unapologetic progressive, but he also supports the state of Israel. And I would love to make my party aware that we should be progressive, Richie Torres progressives.
So you must have been disappointed that the vice president wasn't at the speech yesterday.
Yeah, incredibly disappointed. I think it's a massive blunder politically. And then it's just personally, but for the Jewish people in the Jewish state, it's incredibly inappropriate, especially this is someone who, of course, not only was at Zelensky's address, but held up a massive Ukrainian flag, because right, that's the way our foreign leaders should be treated, especially foreign countries that are involved in an existential war. So it's pretty inexcusable. And then I will add, just because, again, I get so many attacks on this, I will continue to call out far-left anti-Semitism and far-right anti-Semitism. So when Donald Trump Jr., was scheduled to appear at an event with Candace Owens, I immediately texted and alerted people on the Trump team, even though this, of course, was not a campaign event. I still said, look, this is inexcusable, and I posted about it publicly. So I'm not beholden to a party. I'm not beholden to a person. I am beholden to policies that I believe in that will create change for the country I love, the United States, and for the people I love, the Jewish people. And if many of my Jewish allies, Jewish liberal allies on social media want to continue to attack me, it's hurtful, but it is what it is. But what I will say is listen to what is coming out of my mouth. Don't assume my politics because you read somewhere or you made assumptions. Listen to what I'm saying and doing, and I would like to be judged on that.
Yeah.
As I said, I will continue to speak out to anyone and everyone on any platform I can get to speak out to create change. As I said, I'm in Denver today speaking in front of 1,500 Democrat and Republican state legislators because I believe really strongly that we need to have allies in every corner of this country.
100%. And you're doing a great job. Look, the most important thing to us, obviously, and especially if you have listened to this show for many years, you know it, is the Jewish community being represented properly and well and, you know, with sincerity and with dignity. And obviously, you do all that no matter what the forum is, whether it's today in Denver or at the RNC or in the courtroom against Harvard University. I greatly appreciate you joining us today. Really appreciate your insight and continued success. Let us know if we could help by publicizing any of this down the road.
Amen. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
I appreciate that. Shabbos Kestenbaum, Thursday morning broadcast. You're listening to JM in the AM.